Good morning and welcome to today's New Energy Chinwag. Today we're joined by Gavin Catto of Green Cat Renewables. Welcome, Gavin.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
John Massey, who is the regular astute presenter. And
Hello, everyone.
Morning, morning, John. And Gavin, without wishing to make you big-headed, I think you've been regarded as something of the developer's developer. Certainly when I was with E.ON 10, 12 years ago, you were held in very high regard by us. I think you actually came and did a piece of strategic work for us when we were looking at on and offshore wind, and where else would you run offshore wind farm from but Leamington Spa in the UK, about as far from the sea as you can get. And since then, I came across Green Cat Developments up in Aberdeenshire when I was with on the onshore team, and more recently a number of occasions with some of the major offshore developments. So perhaps we can start by just asking you, what are you up to at the moment, Gavin? What's keeping you out of mischief?
Okay, first of all, I'm interested by the introduction. I wouldn't really describe myself as a developer. We've always seen ourselves as a development support company. We've almost been an accidental developer in that a number of projects we've worked on, we've been kind of invited in as partners. But we've never actually gone out and sought to develop projects. Those are just opportunities. And I almost see our development activities as more of an alternative way of looking at commercials. We've never just gone for the straight vanilla selling hours and getting paid for that. We've always worked with our partners. And a lot of our partners are themselves not conventional developers. So we've done a lot of work with farmers or businesses where energy is a sort of side issue rather than the main issue. Obviously, we do a lot of work with the mainstream developers as well, but certainly our development activity has been in a sort of supporting role, although we do now have a number of projects where we've developed fully ourselves.
That's interesting you say that. There's a lot of talk, certainly in the offshore wind and hydrogen fields, about this great new sexy phrase, sector coupling. It sounds from what you're saying that you've been sector coupling for many, many years. You've done it organically and you've brought together stakeholders. I would imagine the agricultural community and people on the ground that you've been doing it for
years. Is there a certain scale that you've kind of limited to, or what kind of scale projects?
No. Historically, our scale has been dictated by our market and our clients. So very early on in our history, we kind of hit a sweet spot with the feed-in tariff. So we did a lot of sub 5 megawatt projects, again, with farmers and latterly with some of the portfolio developers that came into that space. But we've never limited ourselves to that. And, nowadays, on the wind side, certainly we're up working at 40, 50 megawatt wind farms. Are arguably still the new bottom end. You know, we specialize in doing things economically. There's a kind of niche for us there. On the other side, the sort of, if you like, the kind of more exciting new stuff, the sort of hydrogen ammonia, we're getting involved in much bigger projects where it's hundreds of megawatts. It's a different market and a different scale. So we're applying a slightly different mindset. Historically, we've typically worked on the projects from the sort of 500 kilowatts up to 5 megawatts, and nowadays, you can almost add a zero onto the end of that.
Would it also be sorry to interrupt, John? Would it also be fair to perhaps also describe you? Not just obviously you've clarified your role there, but it also would it also be fair to say that you're actually something of an investor as well these days?
Oh yeah, very much so. I mean, we've taken a strategic investment in Enius, the sort of ammonia development business that you'll be aware of. And yes, we have invested in a number of projects and business ventures over the years. I wouldn't say that we've stacks of cash to invest. It's more we make strategic investments where we think we can add value. Very often our investment will be tied to doing work, either whether that's through our contracting business, actually building things out,
or through the consultancy business or through our own development.
Yeah, John and I were in Calgary a year or two ago, and you've got an office in Calgary as well. So you've got a North American presence as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's at the moment that office is predominantly a consultancy based office, but it is growing rapidly. And the market's obviously different. There is no real bottom end. I mean, even the community projects are typically 20 megawatt projects. So that's kind of bottom end. And I think the biggest project we're working on is 400 megawatts. So it's a very different scale to what we're doing in the UK. But whereas in the UK, we tend to be, almost sort of one-stop shop, where we're taking a very wide range of support for our clients. In North America, it's very much, it's broken up. So we do a wide variety of smaller elements of support on those projects.
So for things like, you mentioned ammonia, it's relatively new. These days you'd regard it as relatively niche. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that is?
Yeah, well, I think you need to step back and see where all this is going. I mean, to my mind, the future is very much going to be about decarbonizing, but the low-hanging fruit's been done. You know, sticking up your dumb wind farm and just letting it pump kilowatt hours into the grid when the wind blows, that doesn't work anymore. You know, the grid can't take it. You know, at the times the wind's there, there's no need for it. We're already seeing periods of negative pricing, and we're already seeing the grid having to increasingly apply curtailment, both through the traditional transmission scale, but also down to the more recent distribution scale curtailment, which kind of works as a sort of short term fix, but. As we move forward, if the sort of penetration of renewables in the system is going to continue, and it almost certainly is, economics is going to dictate that, we need to balance the books. You know, there needs to be some way of making wind either more controllable or else making the demand more controllable. And also, as you start to move away from electricity and start to move into heat and transport, actually, converting that electricity, those electrons, into sort of chemical energy or battery energy of one form or another has to be done. And hydrogen is an interesting vector, but it's a very difficult beast to deal with, to transport. What we're working on is taking a step further and converting that hydrogen into ammonia, which is a much more manageable way of storing that chemical energy and transporting it to the point of use.
Now, obviously, you focus on projects that are economic, which is obviously helpful. With ammonia, I mean, at the moment, can that compete with just traditional ammonia? Do you need solutions in place to help it?
Good question. I think the simple answer is today, no, it can't. I think it's very, very close. But there are a number of moving parts, and you can make it stack up depending how you look at carbon pricing and how you look at risk. So if you take a low view on risk and you take a fairly high value on carbon, then yes, it stacks up. If you're looking at just how much pounds it costs to create a kilo of ammonia from renewables compared with steam reformation of methane, then no, obviously you can, it's still, there's still a margin there. It's not a huge margin, and it depends how much you're paying for the few kilowatt hours. Now in the US, which is where we're kind of leading on, certainly on the big project, a few small projects in the UK, with the way their sort of tax credit system works, the price paid for kilowatt hour is very, very low, and we're getting down to very, very close to being competitive with brown ammonia or fossil fuel derived ammonia.
Do you think there's a premium from the buyer's side? I mean, is there a kind of market pull to buy clean ammonia?
I think that it depends which market you go into. The problem is that the markets with the greatest premium are the smallest markets. So actually trying to pull together a commercial model for a large scale ammonia plant selling to many small scale end users doesn't really work out. So, you know, we have to move back down the chain a bit to find a sort of off-taker that has you know, suitable credit rating, which erodes that premium. You know, there's other people in the chain who are you know, sort of tapping into that premium. And one of the interesting things that we didn't expect, I mean, originally we were very much focused on the hydrogen market. So, you know, we were just looking at it as a transport vector. But increasingly, there are actually markets for green ammonia directly. Some as fertilizers, but particularly a very exciting area in that regard is for shipping fuels. And, you know, as an alternative to diesel or heavy oil fuels.
Yeah, I did read, Gavin, I think from the Lloyd's Register, that the shipping industry has got some very ambitious decarbonisation targets, yeah. I think by 2035, 15 years, which is nothing for those of us used to major projects. You would hope to be pretty well advanced to meet that kind of timeline.
It's difficult. I mean, I think direct hydrogen propulsion of ships is not easy. I mean, I think there are a few out there, but I'm not convinced that's the answer. So I think ammonia may very well be the final answer. Certainly, there's a number of people out there who think that it's the answer.
And to push it even further, I did think, I don't know if you come across this reaction engine mentioned by, I think, Rolls-Royce are now investors in, and this is some kind of ammonia to jet aviation fuel or propulsion. People, I mean, traditionally, when we talked about hydrogen, every time we talk about hydrogen, the Hindenburg doesn't take long before that comes into people's minds. There's a lot of scary stuff out there. And I suppose it's similar with ammonia to the layman. But if you come from an oil and gas background, well, you deal with scary stuff all the time. And it's just a case of you do it properly, then I suppose some of the risk is then mitigated like anything else. It doesn't take much for a couple of scary images out there to distort.
I'm not so sure about ammonia as a direct aviation fuel. I mean, it's quite heavy for the amount of energy it carries, but certainly for shipping, with the weight isn't particularly a factor. I think it makes an awful lot of sense. And, you know, it is toxic. It is corrosive. So it's not a trivial matter moving ammonia around. But you know, the fertilizer industry has been doing that, and chemicals industry has been doing it for years. And you know, the bulk storage and movement of ammonia is very well understood. It's got very mature sort of regulation. So certainly moving it around and using it for you know, terrestrial use, I don't think there's an issue at all.
And it's quite.
Have you, I mean, in terms of things like wind congestion constraint and so on, have you also done things with battery as well? Because obviously there's a big argument, whatever you want to call it, between batteries versus fuels from wind and absolutely. Efficiency.
I mean, we have a number of battery projects. We're struggling, I would have to say, to make them stack up with wind projects. I think the lithium ion, it has its place. It works very well with solars when you're just doing a time shift, but it's not a great marriage with wind power. The storage to the power capacity just doesn't work. We spent quite a bit of time looking at flow batteries, and I'm sure we will eventually install some flow batteries. And I personally think a very neat hybrid is wind, solar, and a flow battery. To create basically a dispatchable generator with it, you know, topping up the overall generation in the summertime. I think there is a place for that. I think that place is not now. I think that place is possibly 2-3 years away before the sort of markets evolve sufficiently to make that stack up. But in any case, at the moment, we have yet to find a flow battery that we're A, comfortable with, and B, is bankable. So
yeah, well, the company isn't going to go bust. Is another.
But and you're confident the thing's going to work for any length of time, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned about lithium ion and the power and energy ratio. What kind of storage durations do you think are viable then with wind? What do you think makes sense with wind?
Well, we've done quite a bit of modelling. I mean, it depends whether you're going for something that's 100% dispatchable, or if you're just trying to find the economic sweet spot. Now, that sweet spot moves around a bit, depending what assumptions you make about the market. But certainly, I mean, we looked in quite detail at one project. It was a 9 megawatts or 9.4 megawatt wind farm and about 6 megawatts of solar. And I think the optimum for us was, I think we were going to put in about 5 megawatts of batteries and, you know, sort of 20 megawatt hours of storage. Which is something we looked at quite seriously, but it, you know, the economics just didn't stack up. The cost of the battery was too high, and let's say that the battery wasn't even financeable in any case.
Thinking about the islands, we had a chat with John Clipsham up on Orkney a few weeks ago, and I gather you've got interests up there as well, Gavin. Is there anything you can tell us a little bit about what you're up to up there?
Orkney, well, we've done a lot of things in Orkney, but I think the thing you're referring to is the NES ammonia project at Hammers Hill, which is currently working its way through the planning system. I mean, can't say too much about it, but Hammers Hill is a project we've worked with the developer up there for many years. So we're applying for an extension to the wind farm there. In Orkney at the moment, until another cable to the mainland is approved, and the needs case there was a needs case, but it was thrown out, so that they're trying to rebuild the needs case for that new cable. But until that goes in, there is no grid capacity at all for new wind there. So we were looking at putting the ammonia plant to take the power from the extension, and potentially also from the original wind farm, or maybe even suck in power from more widely, because there are periods of curtailment of other wind projects up there. But I mean, Orkney is very, very interesting. The council is very progressive. They are very much aspirational to install hydrogen wherever they can for their hydrogen ferries, which has had a few problems. But I mean, the political will is there to make that happen. I mean, there's a few other significant demands that we're talking to as well for that. And I think that could be a very, very interesting sort of demonstrator of what's possible.
Yeah, I've been looking at the ScotWind, the leasing round, and it just struck me. I was PM of the Isla offshore wind farm a few years ago. There were a couple of seabed issues with hard crystalline rocks and cables on it, so there are a few economic issues, but I noticed that Isla is now back, and it's back in much bigger form. So I'm really watching that space now to see somewhere, like you mentioned, the grid issue, and whether there's some kind of a hybrid where you could have part traditional offshore wind foundations in the shallower parts, part floating, and also knowing how the grid works, it's not just you don't just ring up and say, "I'll have a 690 megawatt connection, please." It doesn't quite work like that. But whether it actually is a hydrogen element, and what I'm getting at here is you might actually have a scheme where you've got a grid, but your grid might only be a portion of your scheme. You might actually say, well, actually, it's 200 megawatts to play with here. What are we going to do? And whether hydrogen might be worth looking at for that.
I mean, we're doing something very similar in the States, you know, with a project that, you know, the first phase would be a 300 megawatt wind farm with a 90 megawatt grid connection. So we just use the grid connection almost for just balancing and for the ancillary supplies. The bulk of the electricity would be converted into ammonia. And rather than only transmission lines, you take it away in the rail line and wagons.
For those of us that used to read or write ESs, and I think paragraph one was something like the purpose for a wind farm is to generate electrical energy, whatever it was called. You're almost rewriting the rule book now. You're always saying, well, it might not be. It might be a production of a molecule. It might be. You're almost saying that you're almost redefining what effects of the wind farm.
I think that's right. I think it's coming slowly, but people are actually starting to rethink what energy is. And you take a step back from whether it's kilowatt hours or whether it's liters of fuel and start, what are we trying to achieve here? What is the energy doing for us? And it's, eventually the grid will be seen as providing a service rather than, it's a bit like Dieter Helms' report a few years ago. You know, it's At the time, I don't think many people took you very seriously, but I think a lot of the points you were making were very fair. I mean, admittedly, a lot of it was biased around trying to justify a new nuclear build, but I think the economics have overtaken that, and I think the same things that he was talking about will happen, but they will happen from renewables, principally.
In that kind of example with the wind farm and the limited grid connection, do you think, because in the kind of wider scheme of things, it kind of gets to whether we should be building more grid, because one obvious solution to that is to extend grid capacity and so on, or what share of that turns into fuels? Because obviously you've got the arguments around the efficiency. If you put it through the grid, electricity end to end, you get a lot more of the electricity you generated than if you turn it into fuels and turn it back into other things at the other end. So, I mean, I guess it's hard to know, but do you have a view on, does there reach a point where we sort of stop building huge amounts of small grid and stop extending grid, and it becomes more economic to do it via fuels? Or do you think that grid is still the kind of fundamental building block, and the fuel bit is a kind of bit of the bit you can't deal with, the bit that's harder to deal with?
I think it's as simple as that. I mean, I don't foresee a future in my lifetime where we're not going to have a national grid moving electricity around. I think that throwing more copper in the air isn't necessarily the solution in all cases, and particularly in the islands off the north and west coast of Scotland. You know, it takes a lot of copper to move those electrons down to London, which, you know, if you look at the national grid, everything eventually sucks into the southeast. So I think in those cases, it makes a lot of sense. I think there's also a lot of sense in actually trying to balance the grid. I mean, another thing that we're looking at is kind of strategic nodes on the grid where we could locate plant, where it would actually be particularly beneficial to the grid to have a controllable load. So it might not be any generation at all. It might be a bit taking demand off, or it may be sometimes as demand, sometimes as generation. But I think in those sort of circumstances, you know, you can achieve a lot more with the grid you've actually got.
That's the electric grid. One of the companies that I was looking at, and from a wind farm perspective, looking at big, big mega projects, but actually started to look at, well, shouldn't we be looking at siting near the gas grid?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not something I know an awful lot about, is the sort of direct injection of hydrogen into the gas grid. In the US, there are actually some ammonia pipelines as well. I don't think it would make sense to put ammonia in the same pipeline as you have methane, but I think you can put hydrogen in. But it's not an area that I fully understand, and I understand there's some technical problems with it as well, of actually sort of pumping the hydrogen.
Yeah.
But certainly as an interim step, I think there's certainly no issue about putting a percentage of the fuel as hydrogen. That seems to work. But it's not a particular market that we're focusing on.
Yeah, we've just had High Deploy 1 here in Kiel, just down the road from me. And obviously with the lockdown and so forth, it's been a little bit overlooked, but I think it's been a big success. I talked to the supply chain involved in building that network, and they're really ready for High Deploy 2, and particularly High Deploy 3, the big regional clusters, which are being moved to. John and I talked to them as well. But I would have thought that looking at the islands, and I know you're very familiar with the island economics, which is slightly different, as a base case, perhaps from elsewhere, that ScotWind is of particular interest. We've already talked about Orkney, which have got a number of, lo and behold, there are a couple of offshore wind sites off there. And of course, Shetland as well, with its oil and gas heritage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's certainly oil and gas on Orkney as well. So certainly that is something that we've looked at. But yeah, very much we are looking at as ammonia, as it's internationally tradable as a commodity. So on the NES side of things, which is, I mean, I should say that, you know, the NES side is a small part of GreenCat. It's just something new that we're involved in. But that side of things, we're very much looking at that as a world sort of commodity market product that we're producing.
So when you put the business case together, you're not just looking at the price of electricity. You're looking at a much, much bigger picture. You need a much wider vision of not just prices of electricity, but ammonia, which I presume takes a lot of electricity to produce already. Let's say, if you're a wind farm developer, electrical energy developer, you'd want to electrify everything. When I was at SSE, it was electrify everything. That was almost a mantra. And I wonder whether even some of the big organizations such as that are now starting to redefine, like you say, the almost existential purpose of the organization. I was with Shell for many years, and I never thought, I used to bang the drum internally, as did my colleague Robert East, about the renewable future. They weren't that interested, but now they're back, and they're back with intent, and they're buying up companies on the vertical integration, and they're looking. And they're looking, I'm sure, when it comes to round four and ScotWind, we can see interesting additions to some mega projects off the Dutch coast of Lissing and Groningen, those kind of places. So the people in the industry, to some extent, are starting to change as well. Have you noticed that on the ground when you talk, when you go to the conferences and you talk to people at different?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely new entrants. I think that there's a bit of a split. I mean, I think that at the moment, renewables in the UK is utterly dominated by offshore wind. I mean, there are plenty of offshore projects happening, but if you look in terms of the sort of percentages nationally, it's a bit offshore wind, and there are a number of new players in that space. I think the government has created a little bit of a problem in the way they've done that. I think the Contracts for Difference are going to lean to basically too much offshore wind coming onto the system too quickly. And I'm not sure it's really been thought through how they're going to cope with that. We've seen a little bit, I think what's happened with the COVID lockdown and this fall off in demand of electricity has given us some hints as to what's going to be happening and what we're going to see. So we're going to have to see the grid applying a lot more, possibly short-term measures, but to curtail and to manage grid stability. So I think that's it's almost become plain vanilla. There's not many innovative. They're innovative, but they're not innovative in terms of, making it controllable. They have these contracts for difference, so they just pump the power rate. I think more effort is going to have to go into storage, into how we manage it. I mean, there's been technical developments. I mean, the capacity factors of wind farms now is much higher than it was. So that in itself helps to some extent with the variability. But we still have the problem that, you know, when the wind stops blowing, we still need the electricity from somewhere. And a lot of that is not being produced particularly efficiently at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's falling back on gas, really, at the moment, isn't it, whenever we have a gap. Do you see, I mean, I guess, from your point of view, once you produce ammonia, do you care where it goes, or is it just a commodity and the end use is kind of irrelevant to you?
At the moment that's where we are. Yeah. It's we're in the energy side. We're not getting into the sort of distribution, how it's used. Yeah. Certainly the projects in Orkney, and you know, we have some other projects in Perthshire that we're taking forward. They are to make it work. We have to get involved in the sort of downstream, and it's. Yeah. It's because it's new, you have to try and pull all the bits together. But certainly, I mean, we've always shied away from getting involved in electricity supply. Mm. So although we've done a lot of behind the wire projects historically, we've often been asked, well, can we sell the power from this project to this customer and that customer? And commercially, that gets quite complicated. Mm. And it's just not an area that we've ever played in. And I see taking, you know, the ammonia back to hydrogen for transport use or whatever it happens to be used for, is that level. It's not where our expertise are. Our expertise is about getting projects in the ground and sort of generating electricity and then, you know, now converting that onto ammonia. Mm-hmm. It's not. I mean, ammonia is one part of the solution. I think that there's probably a much bigger part is taking what we've got just now, is this huge fleet of onshore wind farms, some of which will be repowered, some of which will have extended lives. But when that comes out of the end of their subsidy period, you know, there's going to be an awful lot of people saying, well, how do we maximize the value of that? And with the way that the electricity markets are changing, the use of system charges are going up. When the DNOs switch across to DSOs, there's going to be a lot of people looking at how they actually manage these projects more actively and more cleverly. So I see a huge opportunity for GreenCats in that space as well. So some of that will be about adding in batteries, but some of it will just be about clever ways of managing the facility, or potentially starting to marry up demands and generators, you know, potentially under the same grid supply point. So we're kind of locally balancing things.
Because there's some interesting kind of local market stuff going on. I mean, Centrica and people down in Cornwall have got these kind of local market trials going on. So are you kind of following that? Do you think that kind of thing will be a big change?
I'm not particularly following the Centrica project, but we are working with artificial intelligence company who are looking at how we can bring in all the technical and the commercial inputs to sort of maximize. I mean, this is linked to the sort of wind, solar, battery project that we're pulling together, and how we can play games with that. That particular one, it's sited on a trading estate, so there's a certain amount of local demand as well. Mm-hmm. So we're marrying the local demand, the local wind generation, the local solar generation, the storage, and potentially a couple of large offsite users, and looking at how we can take what is a very complicated system and maximize the revenues out of that.
Yeah, I mean, and I suppose related to that, there's been a lot of activity in the kind of aggregation virtual power plant field. Is that something you can see kind of these end of feed-in tariff wind farms getting attached into?
I think so. It's not something we've done to date, but there are people that we're speaking to, and I think those guys, as I was saying earlier, you know, we don't really understand the markets. We need to be able to understand it enough to control our projects and get the most out of our projects. But really, we're going to be partnering up with the guys who do the trading and take it out to the market.
Yeah.
Thinking, Gavin, about some of the prospecting side of things. I suppose in the old early days of wind, it'd be, well, lo and behold, you look where the resource is, you look where the wind is. But I wonder whether they actually might be thinking a little bit different now. You might be looking at, I think, pinch points, I think you mentioned, on the grid, not just the electric grid, but so you might be looking for the gas grid. You might be looking at strategic thinking. You might, the GIS might be looking at, you might be looking at where the substations are, where the offshore wind farms are coming up above Dunbar.
Well, we've always been very interested in the grid. I mean, grid in Scotland has been, you know, almost as big an issue as planning all right the way through, you know, when GreenCats, since GreenCats been in existence. So that certainly is the case. And actually understanding the technical pinch points, but also trying to understand the evolving market, particularly the sort of balancing system and the use of system charging, so that we can understand where on the grid is the best place is very much part of the thinking of what we're doing with NES. It's not something, I mean, we're not prospecting. I mean, as I say, we're not a developer in the sense that we're not out looking for new wind farm sites. So we're not prospecting there or solar or any other kind of generation. But when sites come to us, it is very much something that we look at as well. How would this project, you know, if a client comes to us with a new site, how is this going to work? And also trying to understand how the market will work, particularly, I mean, with Contracts for Difference opening up for onshore wind, I'm not actually sure how useful a thing that is. I'm not sure how many of the sort of projects that we work on will actually ever achieve Contracts for Difference. But, you know, a few years ago, we were looking at projects on a purely merchant basis or in some cases, bilateral contracts. That is getting much tougher now, you know, particularly with the offshore wind farms coming on. We're seeing wind sort of cannibalizing its own market. So wind electricity is worth a lot less than, you know, the average price of electricity or, you know, electricity from a dispatchable generator.
Yeah, which again, that makes the adding something to it more interesting. If you can time shift or place shift the energy, it just makes it more valuable. Yeah.
Thinking a little bit, Gavin, about from an investor perspective. I mean, obviously, you come from a background of actually delivering, and do you think that makes what you look for, the due diligence, a little bit different than it might be for the banks or people that come from outside the third parties?
I think possibly it does. I mean, it's certainly something that we see, that there are certain risks that we understand and we are very comfortable with, and the banks that we've worked with have got comfortable with, particularly around things about non-firm grid capacity. There are certain banks that just get totally spooked by that, and I've seen nonsense written, frankly, in a lot of due diligence reports about that. What I think we've always been very good at is, okay, it's non-firm capacity. Why is it non-firm? And drilling down to what it is that's causing the non-firmness. Once you understand what that is, and it's all there, it's all understood, it's actually relatively straightforward to make an assessment then of what that impact is. So we did a project up in Aberdeenshire, which we had to take non-firm grid capacity for a few years, which allowed us to get it away just at the back end of the renewables obligation. And yeah, we'd quite a battle getting it through. And I think ultimately it was curtailed in the first 2 years. It was curtailed like 4 days. I mean, it was utterly irrelevant in the overall project economic. But we were able to do that by just understanding that the constraint wasn't a real constraint. It was a contractual constraint. There's contractual constraint from projects that were hogging grid capacity and had to be considered there by the grid operator. But we knew that they didn't even have planning consent. So there was no way that they were going to come in and interfere with our project and the timescale the non-firm connection lasted for. So I think from our point of view, we are quite good at understanding the risk and drilling into the risks. Same, I mean, another area that projects often get bogged down on is land rights. There are some land rights that are absolute. You need to have the right to access to your project. But there are other land rights that you will always find a way around it. You know, whale use for grid connections is a classic one. You know. If the absolute worst comes to the worst, you end up, burying the cable in the road. But the reality is that sets a price, and you then, with that ceiling, you will always manage to do a deal with the sort of landowners or farmers to get your cabling in.
Yeah, interesting. And you mentioned about North America. Are we talking about fundamentally the same issues around grid as we see here? Are there any significant differences between the two?
Yes, I think the grid issues are some. I mean, there are actually some technical differences and things that they're worried about. Whether those are actually real or whether they're just perceived, I don't know. But grid stability is a much bigger thing in the US, but possibly because of the blackouts they had early on in the deregulation journey. I mean, the other thing with the US is it's not a US grid, but there are many US grids that come under different regulations. Some of them are heavily regulated, some of them are completely deregulated. There's a number of different markets you need to understand. But fundamentally, there's the same problem. There's a lot of wind power and solar, but particularly wind power. And a lot of the, where that's wind resource is, the grid is saturated in those areas. So there's a lot of projects that are consented. I mean, consent is much easier in the US, but if you can't get away, you can't get away. So there are a number of stranded projects that you can't get access to the grid in the US.
Mm. John and I have just been teaching a World Hydrogen Leaders course for the Green Power Academy, and some of the feedback from there is actually, you've talked about it yourself, that the constraints, yeah, they're there, but actually that certainly could be an opportunity as well, that rather than just throwing one's hands up, you could actually take a step back and say, well, all right, the electrons might not be able to get away. Is there any other method of getting the power away in some form? And that actually might be a driver for some of the tech that we've talked about here. Do you agree with that?
Totally. I think that, at the moment, it's one of the things, everybody's kind of waiting to get the first project away. And I mean, there are some demonstrators there, but it's, once somebody gets an actual commercial model, it could open the floodgates, which interestingly is one of the risks. If we're trying to build a project, a major capital investment, you're looking for long-term offtake agreements.
Mm.
If the market suddenly takes off, the price could fall and the early projects could be left a little high and dry because obviously the first projects will be the most expensive ones. So it is one of the challenges to actually get this market going.
Yeah. Everyone, certainly in the hydrogen sector, everyone's kind of waiting for kind of policy and beating the government's door down around having hydrogen strategy and so on. I mean, from your point of view, do you think that's as vital as people make out, and kind of what kind of things would you like to see in it?
Yeah, I think it is. I think we will get projects away, but the projects we'll get away, certainly in the UK, are going to be niche projects. Mm. They're probably going to get some form of capital grants just to help the sort of proof of concept and demonstration. I think for the market to take off, that there needs to be something there. And it's all about bankability. These are multi-million pound projects and hundreds of millions of pounds potentially. It needs to be bankable and it needs to be long-term. It's a significant capital investment. So you need certainty of your revenues to actually make that bankable and make the whole thing fundable. And that, I think that's where the government comes in. It needs a strategy and it needs, I don't really matters how the market works, but you just need to have a reasonable sort of horizon that you can see sort of certainty of what the income is going to be.
Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, there's all these announcements over the summer about kind of targets and strategies, but I think none of them yet have come with any actual mechanisms to get them to happen.
I mean, there's many. I mean, a Contracts for Difference's approach has been muted, and that would work.
Mm.
That meets the criteria of making it bankable. But I mean, there's other mechanisms as well. It could be some manner of obligation. I'm fairly agnostic to how they do it, but it needs to have a sufficient years of visibility ahead that we can borrow money against it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it'd be interesting to see how slowly/quickly. I gather because they set up this, I can't remember what they call it, the hydrogen group government. They met in the end of July, I think, for the first time. So I guess we'll see what happens as a result of that.
Yeah, I think they wrote a letter, John, not the most storming start I've ever heard of, but I'm sure they have to play the lobbying card in a stealthy manner. But I know that offshore wind has now managed to get something that we've talked about, an offshore sector deal, which is... Is something that's almost unthinkable to those of us that were part of that industry. So Gavin, if you were to cast your mind forward now and look at the coming years, are you optimistic about the state of how far wind has come, how far renewables has come? It's no longer perhaps a boutique.
Well, I'm very optimistic in the sense that we're not going back to a fossil fuel based thing. The future is going to be renewables. I think that the government does need a strategy and it does need to put that in place. I don't really think that Ofgem are looking far enough ahead. I mean, I see all the consultations now talk about getting to net zero, but I don't think they really believe it. And I don't think they really think, well, that actually means us doing something. So I think that there's still a way to go there and getting that message through to I think the message is there, but getting it turned into action, both from sort of BEIS, from Ofgem, and indeed from the Scottish Government, I don't think fully gets it. They talk grandly about what they want to achieve, but again, I don't quite get that. That means them actually putting in place policies that enable it to happen.
Yeah, interesting.
But no, I think the future is good. I think, you know, and it's going to be messy. And, you know, there's going to be a certain amount of, you know, making up as we go along. But I think for a company like Green Cat, we're not particularly going to hang a hat in any particular route. We know the direction of travel, and, you know, we have a number of things that we're involved in that broadly tie with that, and we will just need to be flexible as things evolve, as to, you know, what our place is in that, and you know, the things that we're doing.
I suppose that the UK, certainly for offshore, is now considered to be a world leader. So I think it's similar sentiments are being stated about wanting to be a world leader on hydrogen. I suppose it's a club with many, many members. There's a hydrogen strategy almost every week or every month appearing at the moment. So, but like we've all said, perhaps it now needs projects on the ground, shovels, the hard bit, if you like, something that you guys seem to specialise project delivery rather than a lot of.
Yeah, I think you know, somebody needs to just leave up and deliver something, and it commercially the first ones probably aren't going to look that pretty, but you know, somebody needs to do it to do the learning to, you know, hopefully do it better as we go forward. I'm not actually that much of a fan of the offshore sector deal. I don't think it's really delivered, and I think it's a disgrace, frankly, that they didn't manage to tie in more of the manufacturing coming to the UK. But, you know, that's a personal view. So I'm not sure a hydrogen sector deal is something I would really want. I would rather that they set a market that worked and then, let the industry work out how best to deliver that rather than actually government getting in the way and failing to achieve what they're
going to do. Would you think, I mean, they managed it with solar and wind originally, so it doesn't seem beyond the bounds of wit of man to kind of copy some of the things that they did with that in terms of long-term contracts and certainty and so on.
Oh, totally. I mean, there's a relatively small number of models. I mean, there's all sorts of features around the basic models, but it is a contract for difference. It is a feed-in tariff, or it is a subsidy mechanism. They all work. And I say I'm fairly agnostic as to how they do it, as long as ultimately what we land up with is a contract that runs for north of 10 years that we can borrow money against.
Gavin, we've had a very insightful discussion with you today, and we talked, I think, for about 50 or so minutes on various themes. Is John and I often ask ourselves, is there any question that we should have asked you that we've not asked you? What would you like to share with the Chinwag listeners today? What is coursing through your brain as we discuss the rather transformational state of the energy industry?
I don't know, to be honest. What should you have asked me? I think we've had a good kick around of things. I mean, the one thing we've kind of avoided talking about is coronavirus and what the impact that has on.
Well, we're all sat here in hundreds of miles apart.
Yeah, and it's kind of the elephant in the room at the moment. We've had the first wave. We probably are going to have some kind of second wave, and that second wave is going to coincide with Brexit. So, you know, it's there, whilst, you know, in the long term, I can kind of see where things are going. I can't see exactly how we're going to get there. But in the short term, for sure, I think there is challenges to us all still being here and, you know, able to do things in the longer term.
Yeah, one area where we did briefly mention it was the impact it had on demand in the spring. I think one difference with the winter is that in the spring, the things like demand turn up and so on was largely about solar. Whereas obviously in the winter, it will, if the same kind of happens and we have decrease in demand, it will coincide much more with wind. So it will kind of, if anything, highlight more some of the balancing issues that you talked about with the wind. So it'd be interesting from a kind of technical point of view, there was some issues there.
Yeah, I'm not sure we're going to have the same level of lockdown. I mean, I think we will have lockdown, but I don't think the country can afford to lockdown the way it did in the springtime. So I'm not sure to what extent energy demand will go down. I think there's also the argument that, you know, a lot more people at home in the wintertime, you know, those homes are going to have to be heated. So that's going to be, you know, it's actually going, it may not have, you know, that the extra demand might sort of offset.
Well, it might actually increase the peak, I guess, because the winter evening peak when people get home. Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Might level 8 because, yeah, you know, everybody's coming home at the same time. Who knows that?
Yeah.
I think the grid will get through that. I mean, there will be a cost to it. People will have to curtail, and there will be compensation paid for that. That may even be sort of limited blackouts. But again, you know, we'll come through that. I think I'm more concerned about what state the economy is going to be in, and just how deep and how long lasting the recession is going to be. And also, you know, depending what happens with Brexit, certainly on the wind sector, you know, a lot of our turbines are imported from Europe. So at the very least, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be issues actually getting components and getting turbines into the country.
Yeah, and I suppose any delay on projects involves increased costs. It pushes back the generation start dates, and all the factors that you look at. You can have all these fancy project programs and written with these bits of fancy software, and then something comes and it blows. it's all. I gather that you've been reasonably exempt in Scotland. Last time you spoke, I think that energy's you've managed to still continue delivering projects even through the lockdown. Is that the case?
Yeah, we had to furlough a few staff early on because you know, a lot of the construction sites were closed. But the office-based staff, we basically set them all up with laptops and everybody was working from home. We never completely closed the office because there was always people needed access to IT resources and files or whatever.
Yeah.
And we're still that situation in Scotland where there's not been a general return to work. The office is open and people come in when they need to, but work at home when they can. And you know, that's just going to have to continue over the course of the winter. I can't see that as an issue. Fortunately, we've not had a big issue. We've not had many employees actually affected with COVID. A number of people had to self-isolate because they either had family members who got it or, you know, who were suspected to have it.
Mm.
But no, and it has definitely taken its toll. I mean, there have been, you know, a few mental health issues as well with employees affected by particularly the furloughed staff, but also the working from home has taken its toll on some people as well.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think unless John, have you got any further questions? I think we've given Gavin a pretty thorough grilling between us this morning. So thank you very much indeed for that, Gavin Cato of Green Cat Renewables, a very insightful view of the current state of the energy transition and one built upon actually project delivery. So thank you very much. It's really appreciated by John and I. Thank you very much indeed. And we hope you enjoyed it as much as we did.
Yeah. No, it's been good fun.
Yeah, thanks, Gavin. Yeah,
okay, good. Right on. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, yeah. Gavin. Thanks.